The Last Bohemians.
Hello everyone, it's been a while. The past 2 years have been a whirlwind, haven't they? And it's been so tricky, to say the least, to figure out how to make this in the way we usually make this. Which is to say, going into our brilliant Bohemian spaces, getting all up in their grills, and grilling them about their extraordinary lives. This part's a little bit cheesy, so you might want to skip it, but I hope you don't. I always knew I was going to make more episodes, but truthfully, I lost my confidence for a while. I lost myself for a while. And then there was the huge, important question of safety. But then, out of the disillusionment, came this renewed sense of purpose, I suppose. I remembered why I was making this series, and it's to create an archive, yes, but also to be a light, a comfort maybe, to make you smile or giggle. And it's a reminder, for me at least, that in order to get shit done, to achieve what you want to achieve on your own terms, you have to face the fact that you might fail and not everyone will like what you do, and you might get it wrong, and that's okay. But this series is also about connection, and I get loads of amazing messages from people all the time telling me they want more. So, I decided to start a Patreon page. I resisted for so long, guys, but I want to keep building the community around The Last Bohemians, and so, yeah, okay, you have to pay, but if you sign up, not only are you contributing towards our production costs, I'm going to give you the good stuff. I've got bonus Bohemians. I've got huge reference lists of things I've been watching and reading and listening to. We're actually getting some merch. I'm going to try and throw in as much other stuff as I can too. So if you'd like to support us in continuing to bring you the best Bohemians from around the world, then head to patreon.com/thelastbohemians. And thank you for coming back. So, for 2022, I've got a triptych of Bohemians, starting with a biggie. It's Maggie Hambling.
Well, this is Esmeralda. It's actually called the famous euphorbia. It grows indoors, as you see.
It's magnificent.
So, we turn up at Maggie Hambling's studio in South London and fight our way through the billowing plumes of smoke to find her. That's cigarette smoke. Maggie is known in the UK for three things: her ferociously striking paintings, her controversial sculptures, and for the ciggy that's always in her hand.
But it was one of the things I learned at art school, was how to roll a cigarette, and I was very proud of being able to do it at a red traffic light.
I'll be honest with you, I was a touch terrified. She fixes you with a hawk-like glare under her puff of grey hair and says things like...
Right, let's get on with it.
Have you been up since 5?
Yes.
Been up 5 hours already.
It's almost cocktail time.
Luckily, her pug dog Peggy was there to break the ice.
Oh, she likes to fuck my leg, excuse me. And, oh, that was a quick one.
Maggie is often called things like the UK's greatest living painter, a gay icon, a national treasure. But though she's celebrated, her public artworks have caused a stir, whether it's the giant scallop that she erected on a beach in her home county of Suffolk, her Oscar Wilde statue, which one newspaper called silly tourist-trapping nonsense, or the recent furore over her statue of early women's rights advocate Mary Wollstonecraft, where she presented Mary naked.
Susie, it's half past.
But while Maggie's well known here, she's only just opening her first ever show in New York in March 2022 at the age of 76.
I don't understand the wranglings of the art world at all. I don't know why they've waited till I'm 76 to give me my first show in New York, but there we are. I'm three of the desirable things. In other words, I'm a woman, I'm a dyke, and I'm older. All those things apparently are pretty hip things to be.
Maggie is a hoot. Here she tells us all about her bohemian art school background, her younger years falling in and out of Soho drinking establishments, her love affair with the Queen of Bohemia in the 50s, Henrietta Moraes, who was Francis Bacon's muse and later her own, and how she deals with a bad review.
This strange thing happened when I was 14. It was an art exam at school and I'd done nothing but flick paint at people and draw attention to myself because I was deeply in love with a biology mistress who was invigilating the exam. And then I saw the clock and it was 3:20 and I realised at 3:30 I got a hand in a painting, so I just did one. And when the results came out a couple of weeks later, I was top of art. And I thought, well, this is quite interesting. I must look into this business. And then I remember staying up till 2:00 in the morning trying to paint the night sky out of my bedroom window, and I took them into school the next day and they were all laid around. And the art teacher, now dead of course, she was called Yvonne Drury, and she came into the room and I was sort of in the corner and I was in the point of tears, and she came up and said, "What's the matter?" And I said, "Well, I was up till 2:00 in the morning trying to paint the night sky and everyone's laughing at them." And so she said a very important thing to me. She said, "It has to be water off a duck's back. Take no notice of anything anyone ever says about your work. You're your own best critic." She was a wonderful woman. So then I took my first two oil paintings under my arm to show Cedric Morris, the East Anglian School of Painting and Drawing. My parents needed some sort of reassurance this was a good idea, and so they'd heard of Cedric Morris and the Artist's House. Cedric Morris and Lett Haynes had started the East Anglian School of Painting and Drawing in 1937 in Dedham. And that was that's first school burnt down, according to myth, from a cigarette butt of Lucian Freud's. And by the time I came along, I went there when I was 15, it had moved to the outskirts of Hadley, where I grew up in Suffolk. And that's where I learned everything that matters. I arrived one summer evening with my first two oil paintings under my arm. Lett was very tall and imposing and rather frightening, and I said, "Is Sir Cedric Morris at home, please?" And he said, "Cedric Morris is having his dinner." So I said, "Well, may I wait, please?" So I went in and Cedric was very charming and giggly. And at the end of this extraordinary meal, I mean, Lett was bringing in dish after dish. I mean, who'd heard of couscous in 1960? In Suffolk. Anyway, at the end of the meal, Cedric said, "We'll put the paintings up there." And he was very encouraging, made certain criticisms, and then Lett wandered back in. Lett by then would have been drinking red wine. And he made entirely the opposite criticisms, but was very encouraging, and said, "I suppose you're still at school." And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, come along and paint in the holidays." And so, first day of the holidays, I was there with my paints, but I was too nervous to go up the drive to the house, so I sat in the ditch at the end of the drive and painted the ditch until this painter called Lucy Harwood came out of the house ringing an enormous cowbell, and I went in, and that's really where life began. And I worked with Lett in the kitchen, and that's where he said the most important thing that anyone's ever said to me. He said, "If you're going to be an artist, you have to make your work your best friend. In other words, you can go to it whatever you're feeling. You're feeling tired, you're feeling bored, you're feeling happy, you're feeling randy, whatever you're feeling. Go to your work and have a conversation with it." And the other great thing he said was, "There's no point in being an artist unless you have imagination." So these wonderful things, I was 15, you know, cutting up carrots the wrong way. But anyway, I mean, everyone was themselves, everyone was treated the same. It didn't matter whether you were, you know, a man or a woman, a boy or a girl, straight or queer, didn't matter. Do you know, everyone was regarded equally. And this thing of being yourself and being independent was dinned into one. And art being the priority of life, you know. And that's what I feel now. I mean, that time in the studio is real time and the rest of life is like a cabaret or something. And I...
The spirit of Cedric.
The Queen. Our I'll turn it off, darling. I'm so sorry.
Not at all. That's an interesting ringtone. Are you a royalist, Maggie?
Of course. Anyway, where were we? Drugs and, a lot of queer business and... I mean, Lett was very good. I mean, it was the time of plastic surgery, and he's had no time for plastic surgery and everyone trying to look the same. You know, he said, if you've got a big nose, have a very big nose. If you're going to be queer, be very queer. You know, it's where I learnt to be independent from fashion or any of that, you know, just to be myself, whoever I am. My mother would have liked me to have married a young farmer or a young conservative, but I lasted about 3 weeks in both of those associations. When I was 7 or 8 at my first school, and Uncle Tom's Cabin was being read to us, and the fashion at the time was making patterns in those old-fashioned arithmetic books, do you know, and if you had a gold crayon, you were absolutely it. You see, and so the book was being read to us, and everyone was making their patterns in the arithmetic books, but I listened to it, and I tried to draw the slaves being beaten. So you could say that was really where art began. You know, drawing is the basis of everything to me, and that's really where it began. And then Oscar Wilde's stories for children were read to us, and so I asked for his complete works for my 12th birthday. My parents were a little surprised, however, I'd got them trained by then. And there was this voice from somewhere else, somewhere very unlike the fields of mud and the rest of it that I grew up in Suffolk. This voice from a strange, exotic place, place of the imagination, and that got me. You know, I still have my blue leather-bound volume of Oscar Wilde, and so The Picture of Dorian Gray was the first novel I ever read at the age of 12.
And is that when you started to become, should we say, fascinated by British bohemianism?
I don't know about this word bohemian, I don't know. I think bohemians died in attics in Paris, didn't they, of TB or something like that, because they hadn't got enough to eat. They were making a television programme about bohemians a year or two ago, and Victoria Coren Mitchell was coming to interview me, and she was a bit late, and I was up in the studio smoking away. And the director said, oh, you can't possibly smoke when you're being interviewed. I said, what? You're making a programme about bohemians and I can't smoke? And so he said, well, you see, Victoria is pregnant, and it wouldn't be a done thing to see you smoking. Well, she came up the stairs and she said, thank God you're smoking. Do puff it at me. You know, the moment I've had this baby, I shall be smoking as much as usual.
How swinging were your 60s, Maggie?
This one. 60s, an art student in London at the time of Grant's. I mean, incredible. And there was the Gateways Club, and there was Carnaby Street, and I was great friends with Derek Jarman, and it was terrific. Done 2 years at Ipswich Art School, 3 years at Camberwell, 2 years at Slade, and in the glorious days of Grant's, unlike nowadays. And so I realised I couldn't be an art student any longer than that 7 years, yes.
You said that you turned up to Camberwell virgin, is that right?
Indeed, I was a virgin up from Suffolk, almost 19. And I was so embarrassed. I made my mother buy me a full-length black leather coat, and I wore her fox fur around my neck and covered in makeup and dyed my hair red. And the other girls came to me, because I looked like someone who ran a brothel, and the other girls came to me for advice on contraception. I fuck knows what I told them. Anyway, at the end of that first year, I was very embarrassed about my state of virginity, and so I had a list, older man, younger man, black man, woman. So I did all that, and I liked the woman the best, and so there it was.
And how did you identify back then?
What do you mean identify? I've never understood this word. What is this word, identify?
What did you call yourself?
Maggie. I mean, come on, what is all this? Derek Drummond asked me always to say queer. Never this sort of rather flippant word, gay. So I always try to remember to say queer. But it's back in again now, I believe.
How do you feel when people call you a queer artist?
Well, I think I'm just an artist, you know. I don't agree with it. I mean, when women's art,
I didn't understand it, because when I was a student in the 60s, Bridget Riley had represented England at the Venice Biennale, so I didn't see all this fuss. And I think, you know, women's exhibitions, I know I was in that one a year or two ago at the Tate, but there we are. I mean, there's a sort of veil, you know, people going to say to themselves, I'm going to see women's art, you know. I mean, nothing to do with it. It's like having shows of people with red hair or queer art or something. I mean, it's just art, and it's whether it's any good or not that matters.
What about being called a national treasure?
I suppose it's quite nice to be a national treasure. I don't know quite, I don't think I get paid for it or anything. I don't think there's any profit in it. I've never conformed to anything. What's the point of conforming? I mean, I don't like all this, these expressions of ist. You know, you're an expressionist or a landscapist or a portraitist or a futurist or something. I'm not an ist of any kind. But when people put you into boxes and they feel quite safe with you, you know, you're an expressionist, for instance, and you're put in the box of expressionism and there you are. Well, I've always refused to be an ist.
Walk us through a night at the Gateways.
The Gateways Club was off Bramerton Street, off the King's Road in Chelsea. And you went down these steep steps. And it was pretty dark and seedy and full of cigarette smoke. Sort of like a meat market for dykes, really. It's delicious. Dusty Springfield permanently on the jukebox. And I was banned for suggestive dancing. I mean, how does one dance unsuggestively? I just don't know that. But I got back in again after a couple of weeks. And then a bit later on, Gina, who ran it, said no more men, which annoyed me a lot because I'd been taken there by a man in the first place. And since the 1920s, it had been a sort of free-for-all. So I took this friend with me, and at the last minute, I mean, parked outside, I mean, it was long before drink driving or any of that, I realised he had enormous hands. And so, amazingly, I had a pair of gloves in the glove pocket, so we tried to struggle these gloves onto his hands. And we went in, and we went down, and we had a drink, and after about 20 minutes, Gina sort of loomed up and said, "That's a man, Maggie." So I had to admit it was a man. And we had to leave, and I got banned again, but I was back in with a couple of weeks. But I don't believe in that, you know, I don't believe in discrimination. I like everyone in together. I did an interview, I don't know, a few years ago, and somebody asked me in a very earnest way, what was it like to come out in the 60s, where I've never been in? I think one's very lucky being in the so-called art world. It might have been more difficult if you were living in a, you know, working in a bank or something, or a politician or something in those days, but it was very gay at Camberwell. When I was a student, Robert Medley was head of painting, and he was very gay, and many other people, queer. I remember we had a gay table in the canteen. And you could only sit down if you were queer or if you were very good looking.
You were surrounded by all of these incredible characters, and in the middle of this cavalcade was Henrietta Moraes. Who was Henrietta?
Well, Henrietta was the Queen of Soho in the 50s, and then the queen of the sort of gypsy cavalcade of drugs and things in the 60s. She was Bacon's muse, and he painted her 15 times. And she was an extraordinary woman and power of nature.
And we met the great friend's Boxing Day lunch in the country. And a lot of people around a big table, and I remember looking across the table, and it was like looking at a Francis Bacon portrait. It was extraordinary. I mean, there was the living, moving, talking Francis Bacon portrait. And then David Sylvester had done this show at the Hayward, and there was a dinner afterwards, and I think that was in 1994. And I got up, and as I was leaving the dinner, she was on a table quite near the door. And so she said, "Hello, hello, when are you inviting me to dinner?" And then she wrote me a letter saying she had some annoying bills of about £300, and could I settle this bill for her, and in exchange she would work. So I really didn't know what she could do except model, and so she came here and she was a force of nature. I became her subject rather than she mine.
What drew you to her?
Well, I suppose it was a combination of her looks and the way she cut through to the truth. Do you know what I mean? You couldn't keep anything from her, you know. She'd just see right through you. She just took me over.
She was a true free spirit.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Do they make them like that anymore?
I'm not sure they do.
So you started painting Henrietta, but you also maybe became a bit of her project.
We were in love, yes.
But you were with someone at the time.
Yeah.
I mean, that must have been tricky to navigate.
Life is tricky, you know. There are levels of things, do you know?
Yeah.
As I said, I became her subject rather than she mine.
Yeah. You've been asked about that line many times, but what do you mean when you say that?
It was like having the muse in front of me, do you know, and I was trying to draw this person. I mean, she was a living muse. And I remember an early painting I did, and we had a break, and she'd come around, and I said, I don't know what I'm going to do with this. She said, that's finished. She's the only person who's ever said to me, that's finished. And that painting over there of her, which is one of my favourite paintings of her. I mean, I worked all day until 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and it had just been rubbish, rubbish, rubbish. So I scrubbed the whole thing out with Terps. You see that kind of grey wash.
Mm.
And that happened in about 10 minutes.
So how did she die?
Well, she had actually given up the drink for the last month of her life. But it was like a dance of death with Henrietta and the drink, you know, and she was sort of defiant. I mean, when she was told she'd got diabetic, she immediately took to the cream cakes in a big way. Do you know, she always challenged everything.
What was that like to be so in love with somebody who was so, you know, hell-bent on self-destruction?
Not too funny. Anyway, I was with her when she died, and she said, come here and give me a hug and another cigarette. And then she perfectly quoted the Oscar Wilde line about one of us has to go about the wallpaper. And then I insisted on ringing her doctor. So she said, oh, all right. And I handed her the telephone. So she actually died telling her doctor a joke on the telephone. I mean, what a way to go.
You continued painting her long after she died. Was that difficult for your partner to accept?
Well, it was my work. Work must be the priority. I mean, some people like my work, some people hate my work, a lot of people are indifferent to it, but it's what I do. George Merley always said I'd go down in art history as Maggie Coffin Hambling. He's one of my closest friends. I miss him enormously. I think that possibly comes from drawing people in their coffins and going on painting them after they've died. I mean, it's a very odd, people are surprised at drawing someone in their coffin, but obviously it's the last time you're going to see them, so it seems to be quite an obvious thing to do. And then I think artists are very lucky in that it's a positive way of grieving. I mean, you know, my stop work on the Oscar Wilde statue and did these big paintings of my father laughing because my father had just died. And then with George Merley, I went on making all these paintings of him for a couple of years after he died, and then when the lorry arrived to take the paintings to the Walker Art Gallery in Liverpool, and I went into the studio the next morning and all the paintings were gone, and I said, look, face it, Maggie, George is dead. But while I was painting him, he was still alive. I mean, but that's true for any of us. If you've really loved someone, the person goes on being alive inside you. I don't know where my work will lead me. I don't know what's going to happen to make me angry about it or to move me to make a piece of work. Life dictates what I do. Certainly might do a portrait tomorrow. Who knows? You know, life dictates, and one thing leads to another. I mean, all the paintings of the waves of the North Sea led to the walls of water, and then they led on to the ice caps melting, and the ice caps melting led on to the animals. You know, something happens, and I suppose I get angry about it and demands that I make a piece of work about it. I suppose I think it's another word for it now, but I'm a manic depressive, to use the old-fashioned term. I mean, I'm either in the depths of doom and gloom about everything, or I'm high as a kite.
You know, it's not entirely masochistic, although I live it permanently with doubt about everything. When a painting actually paints itself, it's a feeling better than anything, better than sex, better than anything.
When did Maggie the artist become Maggie the personality?
Well, when I was the first artist in residence at the National Gallery, it was a huge thing. I mean, I don't see why, but people were kind of amazed at a living artist being in the National Gallery with all those dead artists on the wall. And it was on Newsnight and everything. It was a huge, huge thing about it. So I suppose, and because I'd done that, they thought I would know a lot of, about art for gallery, the art quiz on television. Yeah, I drank vodka throughout and smoked. You see, the television thing came after that. And because of the gallery thing, I was recognised in the street, and people would say, "You're that Maggie Hambling, aren't you?" And I'd say, "Yes." They'd say, "Aren't you short?" I mean, as if you were on television, you were somehow tall, do you know? And I remember the Great Bacon Show at the Tate in 1985, and they came down from the private view, and there was a little posse of people on the street, and they wanted me to sign a petition because the sponsor of the show had made brakes for a bomber or something like that. So, of course, I refused to sign it. As I walked off up the street, the bloke called after me, "You're not much bloody good on television either."
What's been the kind of most memorable controversy?
Right, I suppose Scallop on Aubra Beach. I mean, a whole lot of people. My sculpture for Benjamin Britten on Aubra Beach in Suffolk. And the words, "I hear those voices that will not be drowned," appear through the steel, so you read them against the sky. And a whole lot of people in Aubra form themselves into a little committee, calling themselves the Voices of the People of Aubra, you know, to get rid of it. And it did have graffiti on it 13 times. But it does amuse me. I mean, when at the height of the controversy about all that, there was half a page in the Telegraph saying it's got to go, nobody wants it. And then 10 years later, you look at the travel section of the Telegraph, where to go in England, and in the middle there's a dirty great picture of Scallop saying, "Come to Aubra." Anyway, I think Aubra has come round to it because they realise how many fish and chips and ice creams they sell on the back of it, because it's become a sort of place of pilgrimage. People have got married at it. They've had a funeral at it, I mean. But nobody wanted the Eiffel Tower in Paris when they first put it there.
Are you comparing the scallop to the Eiffel Tower, Maggie?
No, not at all. I'm just saying.
See, I thought you were going to say Mary Wollstonecraft's bush.
Wollstonecraft.
Oh, gosh. I knew I was going to get that wrong and you were going to roll your eyes. I knew it. Mary's hairy bush. That's what I thought you were going to say.
No. Now, what annoyed me about all that? Well, it was during lockdown, so it was installed by Arch Bronze in Putney, who I'd made it with, and
a sculpture.
The sculpture was installed in Newington Green, and on the Monday. And then it sort of, the shit hit the fan on the Tuesday, and a friend of mine, the writer Paul Bailey, always watches the Channel 4 News, and 2 minutes after the Channel 4 News on that Tuesday, he rang me and said, "Well, you have put the pussy among the pigeons this time." Never mind Scallop. But I loved that, put the pussy among the pigeons. And then I was leaving Waitrose about the same time with my trolley full of stuff, and one of the lovely Suffolk ladies gave me a big grin and said, "Been making trouble again, I see." But, you know, I didn't set out to make trouble. I just made that sculpture in the spirit of Mary Wollstonecraft.
You say you don't set out to be controversial, but does part of you enjoy it a little bit, you know?
And as Oscar Wilde said, you know, when the critics are divided, the artist is at one with himself. And then that great actor, Donald Wolfit, and he got a good review, he'd say, "Written by an intelligent person." And if he got a bad review, he just said, "Written by one of my enemies." You know, it's all the same. I never set out to be controversial. It just sort of seems to happen. But it does prove there's a bit of life to what I've done. If it causes such a fuss, I don't set out to make a fuss, but, you know, it seems to happen, particularly with the sculpture.
Have you ever tried to give up?
Smoking? I did give up for 5 years, because my father gave up when he was 59. And people were always saying to me, you know, when are you going to give up? When are you? And I used to say breezily in a bravura way, oh, I'll give up when I'm 59. But I do actually try to do what I say I'm going to do. A lot of people don't, but I do. So 59 came around, and so I had to fucking well give up. And I thought I'd never paint again, you know. I sort of took to my bed, I watched television all day, I ate a lot of muesli bars. But gradually, I'd get up here for an hour and then a couple of hours and then talking. And then 5 years later, this big bronze wave sculpture was being installed in Suffolk. And this big bronze wave was hanging off a chain on a JCB and waving in the air. And Dennis Pegg, who'd worked on the scallop, was on the ground doing the installation of it. He said, come on, Mag, do you want it this way a bit or that way a bit? Come on, we haven't got all day, come on. And it was driving me mad. So I said to my friend Squeaky, I said, and it was my birthday, I said, for God's sake, go and get me some cigarettes. I said, get those awful toothpaste ones. I won't like them. I've smoked menthol ever since.
Why do you insist on being photographed with a fag in your hand?
Well, I'm very political about it. I mean, during those 5 years, I had an excellent imitation cigarette, which I always use for photographs. I don't believe in being told what to do. I live my life full of doubt, you know, about the whole thing.
I find that so hard to believe.
I don't think anyone who doesn't suffer from doubt is any good, really. I mean, I have huge doubts the whole time. And it's very odd because I can have my whiskey at 6 o'clock and think I've had a good day in the studio and I look at it the next morning and it's shit and vice versa. There's never a rule, you know, and but it's not entirely masochistic. When a painting paints itself, you know, the muses arrive finally, the fickle thing that it is, and a painting paints itself. And I'm not in charge of that. I mean, I don't know what's happening at all. I mean, people see faces and animals and people in my wave paintings and that, which they point out to me. I'm not aware of them being there, do you know? So when a painting is really happening, that's the best moment in the world. Better than sex, better than anything.
When do you know, then, if something's good
or not? The classic question, how do you know when something's finished? Well,
No, if something's good or not.
I don't know. But the classic question is asked, how do you know? It's very easy to start a painting. It's quite difficult to finish it. And the best answer I found was what Andy Warhol said when he was asked how he knew when something was finished. And he just said, when it's sold. Best answer ever. I mean, nothing to do with the money. It's gone. You can't fiddle with it. I mean, there comes a moment in a painting when, you know, you're feeling rather pleased with it, and then it's very tempting to go on fiddling about or tidying it up, and then you kill it, you see. So it's very tricky. Very tricky.
Is it true that you've never taken a holiday?
Well, I don't take holidays, no.
Why?
Well, because if for some reason I'm ill or something and don't paint for a day and a half, I go pottier than ever. I feel completely lost. I don't know where I am or who I am or anything. Is that going potty? I don't know.
So if you work all the time, have you ever suffered from burnout?
No. I have to do it. I have to get up and do it. I just have to.
I wondered, have you ever thought about writing your memoir?
Oh, well, some publisher did come a couple of years ago and asked me to write an autobiography. And I said, no, not yet. But I've got a great title. But you're so young, you probably don't know the song. There's a wonderful song when I was younger, which was Cigarettes and Whiskey and Wild, Wild Women. So I was going to call my book Cigarettes and Whiskey and Not Enough Wild Women.
Do you mean that there's not enough wild women like you, or there haven't been enough wild women in your life?
Well, there's never been enough wild women in one's life, has there?
It sounds like you've had your fair share, Maggie.
Kept my end up. That's it.
This episode of The Last Bohemians was presented by Kate Hutchinson and produced by me, Hannah Fisher, with additional reporting by Georgie Rogers. Head to The Last Bohemians Instagram page for photography by Laura Kelly and sign up to our Patreon for more Bohemian content.